groceries and whatever we had for supper.
I'm not complaining. That's fine.
Sure was good.
You know, we gotta get some more of that cabbage, guys. And I forgot.
What do rutabagas taste like? Are they like a turnip?
So like a turnip.
Are they better or worse?
I think they're worse, don't you?
I don't know. I imagine they are.
Just the name throws me off a little
bit. Well, you know, Rick, I tell you the truth. I've been sweating that thing out now for some time, and I've been getting more and more miserable. And they ought to know that, you see, when I get this so hard to live like that, all she's got to do is just look the other way.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you can't hardly leave, but you don't have to pay any attention to it. And I get in bad shape, and I never am able to do those things the easy way. This ain't been hanging over me all this time. I've put it off and done everything I could to get rid of it. And then this morning didn't do a thing. Nothing happened. I don't think anything happened the time you left, Faye.
I don't know. I just went in and closed the door, but I don't believe it has.
I don't think it happened till after you left. And once you get it, get going, you're all right. And I took it over to Rick, make him look at it, and told him I thought that was it. You know, not the final thing, but something at least enough, you know, that somebody could work on it. Then I tied it up just a little bit. So you just won't have to worry about that now.
That's good. And that also came at a time when you realized you were out of hay.
Oh, yes.
And that hurts. that's about the worst thing that can happen around here is to realize that winter's not over and you're out of hay.
Yeah.
That's some green leaves. The gums.
Cool.
Yeah.
It's starting to be spring. It really is. I noticed that when I came back last weekend. I could see the difference in the green. Just three days gone.
Yes.
Let's see the difference.
And this red bud, the other red bud's come out.
You got a green leaf?
And the first one has come out again. Did you notice that?
Oh, it has.
Yeah.
I didn't notice.
Part of it.
There's one fresh gum leaf.
Look at that.
I wish you
a baby leaf.
Yeah. Spring is coming.
Oh, I tell you, they really thrive here. This is half of the world.
Gone. Well, we can use some green grass now.
Yeah. Well, anybody could help me make any transitions they want to. I've stopped my one. I'm not going to read you anything. But I'm tired thinking about it.
I don't suppose you saw anything green uptown.
Mm. Well, Miss Neeland was working in his garden. He worked in his garden all afternoon. I was a little concerned when I went over there because he was sitting on the couch when I went in. And I thought, uh-oh, he's here, and I want to talk to Mrs. Neeland. Then I thought, well, he doesn't hear. I'm not going to let him talk to me. I'm going to talk to Mrs. Neeland. And I'm just not going to let him talk. So I did that. I just talked to her for the first 5 minutes. I just went on and on about my new boots, talking to her. Well, he tried to get in a couple times, and he couldn't. So he read the paper for another 5 minutes, and then he got bored and got up and left and went outside and gardened all afternoon.
See, she's learning.
I just didn't give him a chance.
Well, congratulations.
Well, Mrs. Neeland and I really had a fine afternoon. I have a view of the Garden Club of Gainesville that I'm sure few people have. Mrs. Neeland has been a member of the Garden Club since 1932 when they came to Gainesville, which is over 40 years. She was president for a year, and she would have been president for a two-year term, except they thought that Louis was going to move to Tallahassee. He was offered another job there in 1939, and he decided not to take it because they had two boys, and they wanted the boys to go, they wanted to stay in a town where there was a university for boys instead of going to Tallahassee where there was a university for girls. So they stayed in Gainesville, but she only served 1 year as president, but she also ran the short course that they give every summer over at the university. She's always head of some kind of committee. And she talked about, I said, well, suppose I wanted to join the Garden Club. She launched into the circles. Garden clubs have circles. There are 500 members. This is no little institution, the Garden Club. It's a mighty one. And they have circles. And it
is it a garden club that has those big petunia shows, comedy shows?
I think they sponsor things like that. I asked her if they did any kind of community work, and she said, well, mostly now, what they do horticulture. Some of them are interested in growing things. And then she said a lot of people are interested in flower arranging. And she thought that was nice because it gave them something to do with their hands. Now, she wasn't interested in it. It was all right for them. And then what she's interested in is a new project that the Garden Club is doing about therapy for medical patients with flowers, building gardens around hospitals so that, for example, blind people can smell the flowers. Or there are certain flowers that are supposed to be particularly soothing for psychiatric patients. And I thought to myself, she's really progressive to latch on to this. This is her interest now in the Garden Club, is this therapeutic use of flowers. She said that all the welfare work that they do is oriented around gardening. They've got that focus, and they don't do anything else that doesn't have something to do with flowers and gardening. And she mentioned, she said, now that with so many members and so many circles, they all have flower names. She never told me the name of hers, but I have this picture of all the circles around Gainesville. There's the Daylily Circle and the Alyssum Circle and the Azalea Circle and the Camellia Circle, and they're all over Gainesville with flower names blooming. She never told me hers. But she said that some of them now, that it's so big that some of them just get together for social things. She said she knows one. All they want to do is play bridge. They're not interested in garden club at all. And she mentioned the men's garden club. And I said, oh, there's a men's garden club. And she says, oh, yes, Louis belongs. He's just fed up with it, just fed up, because all they do is get together on the second Monday of every month and drink coffee and have donuts and have a speaker, and they won't do anything. Louis is just fed up with them. He tried to get them to go out and clean up at the new, at Howard Bishop, I guess, and do some planting. And she said it was just like pulling teeth to get them to go out there, and Louis is really fed up. She said, you know what one man even suggested? And I said, no, what? And she said, they have $150 in the treasury, and he suggested that they just have a party with it.
Well, but, don't you know that would get Mrs. Neeland's goat?
Oh, yeah. I know. It would really do it to him. And she said, no, it used to be that the garden club was really something. When it was small, she said when she was president, there were only six circles. Now, a circle is just like having a smaller club in the big club. It's 15 to 30 members. And she said there were six when she was president. And she said everybody wanted to do things. And she said they used to plant all over town. They'd get out and plant azaleas and plant trees, and they'd work with the men's garden club. This was in the 30s and 40s. She said it was so nice because everybody wanted to do something active and visible with the plants. She said now all they're doing is reaching deeper and deeper into your pocket. All they want to do is get more dues out of you. She said, it's nobody wants to do anything anymore. And
well, that's odd.
They just, and she gave an example. There's a camp that they're running down in South Florida that all the garden clubs in the state are sponsoring. And supposedly each garden club is supposed to give a certain amount of money. Well, instead of trying to raise the money, all they're doing is adding it onto the dues. So that everybody just has to pay for it out of their pocket. And that's what she means. But she gave that as an example. But I saw her, I think, she's a real individualist in institutions. She ran the short course at the university, which is in the summertime, and they get speakers to come and talk about horticulture and things like that. And she just ran the registration and collecting the little fee. She said it used to be just a nominal fee of $2 or something to pay the speaker. And then she said they used to give you just a manual on horticulture when they'd mimeograph this manual, and she was in charge of seeing that got handed out to everybody. She said one time, and she had to see that it ran smoothly, that all the speakers got up in front of the podium and had the microphone and everything. So I said, it's mostly sort of administration. And she said, yeah, she just had to be there and see that everything went off all right. And so one time, the speaker was in the process of giving his speech, and in came one of the deans with President Tigert behind him and said to her, President Tigert would like to talk to your group. Interrupt the speaker and let President Tigert speak. And she turned around to him and she said, I will not do it. This man is giving a speech and President Tigert can just wait until until he's through. She's very polite, you know, but she's got starch. She stands up to him. She really does. Uh-huh. And then another time, what amazed me was that she's a sturdy little individualist. But she's very conscious of the rules, and she's very conscious of the institution, because the institution was always something that she wanted to work for, that it was something that she could work in, and she was in favor of. But she was in favor of planting azaleas with the garden club. But she always follows the rules, because the institution has never, she can be flexible enough within it. She said to me, another example of this short course was that one of the speakers was giving his speech, and he looked out in the audience and he saw one of his old profs. She always calls everybody at the university an old prof. So he saw his old prof down there, she says, and he thought it would be a fine idea to interrupt the program and bring his prof up to speak. So he did. And she didn't do anything about it, because it was on the tag end of this person's allotted speech time. She said, well, what happened? You know what happened? I said, no. She said, that prof took up the next speaker's time. The next speaker was Dean Hume. She said, come time for Dean Hume to speak after this old prof got through, Dean Hume had left. She said, I think he should have. Those men have got obligations. Why, he probably had obligations for the rest of the afternoon. He should have left. That was wrong for that man to do that. He broke the rules. But she wouldn't let somebody else come in and break the rules like President Tigert either. You know, the rules were there. You stayed in your space to speak. Well, she's I got straight finally the work that she did.
See, you got a wiggle word over here. We're gonna have to disband, let them exercise a little bit.
I'm not with it. We're all right.
You're telling you the one.
Go ahead. We're listening.
So, I finally got straight that business about the welfare work that she did for the women's club. I started out just trying to see all the different institutions that she has been so active in here in Gainesville, because that's what her life has been since 1932. It's been all these organizations. Well, the women's club, I had it completely muddled up from the first time. I thought she'd done a free lunch thing, program for school kids. I don't know how I got that idea. What they did was take clothes. People donated clothes, old clothes, or worn out clothes, and they cut them down for needy school children in the county. And it was run, the Women's Club did the work and gave the clothes to an organization called Immediate Help that they used to have in Gainesville in the 30s. And Immediate Help parceled it out. And she said she really enjoyed that, and she ran it for 10 years. She ran the whole thing, and the lunch business was that she arranged a way to give them lunch for 35 cents so that they'd stay all day and work all day. And she explained, she said, we really had fun doing that. She said, like, you get an old pair of overalls, and you want to cut it, a man's overalls, you want to cut it down for a child. What do you do? I said, I don't know. I wouldn't know what to do. She said, all right, you look at the knees. The knees are all worn out. You cut it off below the knees. And you use the good material that's at the bottom of the leg, where it doesn't get much wear, and you make those the legs for the child. Then you take the bib, and you cut the bib down, and you put them on the legs down there, and you make a new pair of overalls for a child. And she said, we really had fun with the dresses, because they just take apart the dresses and design the clothes using the material. They just completely dismantle them and mix and match all the different kinds of material and make new dresses. So it really must have been quite a creative thing to, I think, designing the patterns must have been.
I heard that somewhere. I haven't talked to her.
Well, and you weren't talking about that when you were here last time.
Well, I talked about
just a little bit
the fact that they cut down school clothes. They cut down clothes for school children, but I didn't understand exactly what it was.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't get it straight the last time, but so she did that for 8 or 10 years, and then she got a little disenchanted with the Women's Club because nobody wanted to take over the program afterwards. And then when they moved out to their new place, she discontinued her membership because she couldn't get out there. She doesn't drive, so she couldn't get out there. But she said, I used to walk to it when it was across from the high school. And I thought, across from the high school. And then I remembered that what is now Santa Fe Junior College used to be Gainesville High School,
mm-hmm.
and the Women's Club, which is now the Little Theater, used to be right across the street. I can remember when it was still across the street over there. Her knowledge of Gainesville is phenomenal. I mean, that's what's interesting, is Gainesville in the 30s, not New York in 1910. Gainesville in the 30s. She knows the names of all the streets that now have numbers. The only one I can remember is 6th Avenue used to be Old Alabama, because we lived right there, and I remember that. But all the streets had names, and she kept calling them names. And I felt like I was back in Gainesville in the 30s, because she'd say the name, and then she'd say, oh, no, now that's Northwest blah, blah, blah Avenue now. And she remembers all the names of anybody that she ever had anything to do with in any organization, and all the names of anybody that had anything to do with Louis. She's got a phenomenal capacity to recall the details.
Well, she just lived it.
And she remembers it. She remembers who was chairman of which committee when she was chairman of this committee, and which year. I said, well, when did you run the short course? And she said, well, Mrs. M.M. Parrish was president from 1935 to 37. And then I must have run the short course from 37 to 39, and then from 39 to 41. And that meant that I was president in 39, I think. I can't remember. I jotted it down. I had it written down. It's just phenomenal. Well, then I said, I knew she'd been in the University Women's Club, too, because of that international relations group that she wrote all the articles for. And I really wanted to see those articles, and so I asked her again if she had any. And she said no, she was sure she didn't, because she'd made a scrapbook out of them. And that the scrapbook had gone to Mrs. So-and-so, who was the historian the year after, and Mrs. So-and-so's house had burned down, so she knew she didn't have any articles. Knew where everything was. Well, then, I have forgotten now, I probably have jotted it down, but I've forgotten the transition to the brothers, but I got there. I asked her.
Oh, yes.
Oh, yes. Well, listen, those brothers really must have been something. I know now why Louis was the one that got left with the family farm. I kept saying to her, she, when I went in, she said, "Oh, you don't want to talk to me. You don't want to talk to me." Louis, and Louis saying, "Oh, she's the interesting one, but it's all the time, you know, he's like this. He wants me to talk to him." And I kept saying, "Well, Mrs. Nealon," I said to her, "Mrs. Nealon, you know, we want to work up a little thing on Mr. Nealon, where all the things he's done." And she, "Well, that I appreciate it very much, but it's too much." And I said, "Oh, no, no, it's not. Oh, it's too much," she said. But I asked her, I know, it was from garden clubs, we talked about terraces, terraced gardens. And then she talked about California, that they have terraced gardens in California. And her son, who's out there now, and she described the flowers that they plant on the banks. And then I got to the farm in Northern California, and then I hit the brothers. I said, "Wasn't it amazing that all four brothers had that same love of the land?" "Oh yes," she said, "they all did." And I said, "Well, did it carry on with all of them?" And she said, "Well, she thought it did, but not to the same extent that it did with Louis." She said she knew they all felt the same way about that farm in California, and she said, "Did I know the story of how they lost it?" And I said, "No." And she said it was the gold. She didn't say the gold dredgers. She said it was industry that had come in on the other side of the mountains, and the little farmers were on this side of the mountain, and so the men who controlled the water rights could get more money from the industry, which I suppose was the gold dredgers. So they just turned the water over the other side of the mountain. And she said all Louis's stepfather, it was his stepfather, all Louis' stepfather wanted to do was get somewhere where it rained. He read about the fact that it rained a lot in Florida. She said, "It does." So they got on a train, and they came to Florida, 1910, and then they were going to get on a boat to go down to Flagler County, and the boys lost their father. So where is he? Can't find him. So they went down to the dock, and they found him on the end of the dock gasping because he couldn't breathe. And he had asthma, and he couldn't breathe in the air. Well, they went on anyway, but he suffered the rest of the time from having asthma until Mr. Nealon found him drinking kerosene. And they did manage to get she called it Hugh Outer Farm in Flagler County. And then the war came, and all four boys went to the war. Then all four boys came back from the war, and they realized that their father couldn't stay there, and nobody wanted to take over the farm. And so Louis said, well, he knew how much it meant to his father, this farm, so he would take it over, and the other boys could go their own way. So they did. And one brother went back to California and ran and farmed in California, and is now, he's still living, and he's in Mexico, not farming anymore. Another brother, this was the oldest brother, Fred, is the one that we should find out about. Fred was outspoken, she said. Fred got kicked out of the University of Florida. I'm dying to know why.
If he's any more outspoken than his brother Louis.
Fred got kicked out of the University of Florida, and he worked, he was very mechanical, she said, so he eventually worked for the railroad in Florida, and he ended up in New Smyrna Beach. And then the third brother, Edwin, went back to California also, but he had gotten TB in the war, and he died shortly after the war. So, but she said that the brother Clarence, I think his name was, that ended up in California farming, she said to me, "You know, I always thought he missed his calling. He should have been an actor." I said, "An actor?" "Oh," she said, "he had a way with words." So it's in all of them. It's in all the brothers. This one of them's outspoken. One of them's an actor. And look at Louis. He's a crusading pioneer. It's in all of them. And she said it carried on in all of them, this love of the land, even though they didn't all farm. Well, two of them farmed. Louis did, and the other brother. But she gave a really nice picture of the farm in Flagler County. It didn't really get back there too much. Well, I guess, yeah, we did, too. Because after after we talked about the brothers, then there we were in Flagler County, so we stayed there for a while. And I got the name of the French Canadian woman from her. I wanted to be sure to get that, and she told me a story about her. When Louis had the potato co-op, she kept the books for the potato co-op. She said to me, "I've never been anywhere where I didn't have something to do." She ran the books, and she kept a chart for each man in the co-op. She said those farmers were suspicious. They were so suspicious all the time. They were a funny lot, she said. Now I said, were their wives like that? Oh, yes, she said. Why, one woman down the road from us got some turkey eggs from her, got a dozen turkey eggs from her sister-in-law. The turkey eggs never hatched. So that woman walked around saying that her sister-in-law gave her bad eggs. Now who would say something like that? Of course she didn't give her bad eggs. They were just a funny lot. But she said she figured she'd arrived there because one day when one of the farmers in the co-op came ungrammatical, one of the farmers in the co-op came in and wanted to see his books, wanted to see his page. And she said, fine. She opened up the book, and there was nothing wrong with it. It was all fine. And he looked it over. He looked at her, looked back at the book, and then he said, well, it's all right. Appreciate it. Walked out. She said that's the most she ever got. They were so suspicious. And she said, one time, you had to just watch them all the time. One time, there was a Mr. Hunter who used to get a crew to do the digging for the potatoes. And Mr. Hunter would come in and dig, and then his pay, they'd pay him to haul the potatoes away so that no one was supposed to haul the potatoes after they were dug. Well, one harvest time, in came Mr. Hunter and all his diggers. They dug the potatoes, and as they were finishing digging, two men that lived on either side of the Neelands came in with their cars and started filling up, getting ready to haul the potatoes away and cheat Mr. Hunter out of what he was rightfully his. Well, she said, Louis just marched out there, told them they couldn't do that. That was not in the contract. It belonged to Mr. Hunter, and they had to quit and go and leave the potatoes for Mr. Hunter. And so Mr. Hunter hauled them off, and she said that afternoon, Mrs. Nigwood, I believe her name is, French-Canadian woman, came to visit. And she'd heard the whole thing about Mr. Neeland kicking these men off the place and everything. She heard the whole thing. She said, this one, that one, no good. Mrs. Neeland said, I knew exactly who she meant because one lived on that side and one lived on the other side. And I said, I asked her if they ever went back to Flagler County, and she said, "Oh, they'd gone back a couple times. They'd gone back recently." And I said, "Oh, there's not too much left in the farm." She said, "No, that there wasn't anything there." But she didn't stay there at all. She jumped right back to when they were living there, and she talked about the wood stove that they had. They had a wood stove, and she liked it. She could cook anything in it. The only thing that was wrong was that you couldn't tell what the temperature was, but she said, you know, I cooked angel cakes in that stove, everything. She said, and the thing to know with wood stoves is you have to know your wood. But you see, I was all set up with Louie. I never had to learn them. Said, you got to know what gets it going fast in the morning and what makes it last all day. And she said, you put in fat pine in the morning and then oak in the afternoon, and oak after the fire's going, and that'll keep it all day. And then she said, and if you want a pretty fire, you throw in some crab apple, and that'll burn green.
Oh.
And I said, oh, it must have been nice there. I said, you ran the farm while he was out being county agent. She said, well, yes, but they'd get pickers. They'd have people come in to do the harvesting whenever there was a crop that needed to be taken in. And she said, that was when I learned about the expression, eat like a truck driver. I said, what? She said, eat like a truck driver. They sure could eat, she said. I said, you had to cook for them. And she said, oh, yes, she had to fix dinner for them. At lunchtime, she said, she used to fix a whole roast And all she'd bake all the bread, and they'd all have all this, all the vegetables from the garden, and fresh milk and fresh cream from the cow. And she said, I'd bake rolls, and I'd bake cornbread, and I'd bake bread, yeast bread. And she said, one time, there was this man named Mr. Moore. He always liked my cornbread, just always liked cornbread. Well, it got to be a little tiring, though. I always had to make cornbread for Mr. Moore. I decided one time I wouldn't do it. I said there's no reason. I said to myself, there's no reason why he can't eat these rolls I'm making, just like everybody else. Why do I have to make cornbread for him? So she didn't. She just made rolls and put them on the table. Didn't say anything. Just put them there. She said all through the meal, his hand kept going like this out to her rolls like that. She said finally, her youngest son, David, piped up from across the table and said, you've had five already. Said he never complained about not having any cornbread.
That's just being there, isn't it?
And then just this.
They he was caught aging 3 years, but then they were there for so long.
They were there 9 years, I think. Something. Well, they went to Trenton in 37. No, that's not right. I can't remember when they were married. 20. He got out of the war in 20. Or, no, 1919 it would have been.
At least, yeah.
I remember that.
Well, he was down. He batched 2 years down there.
So it must have been almost 23 or 24 before they married.
Yeah.
And they came to Gainesville in 32. They left there in 27, I think. So it wasn't as long as I thought. I thought I remembered her saying that they were there 9 years, but maybe that was all of them. I mean, maybe that included Louis' time too there, the time that he lived on the farm.
Well, even so, it's longer than I thought he was there. I thought he just had 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of aging.
Longer than that.
Yeah.
And then they went to Trenton for 3 years, three or 4 years. And then they went to, and then they came to Gainesville.
To Trenton?
To Trenton.
West of town?
Mm-hmm.
And then they came to Gainesville.
Mm-hmm.
Because
he had that land use planning,
yeah,
of it, that job, when he went around and made the map of the state.
Yeah.
She remembers all, she said it's those, I may have this confused, I might, but she didn't. She knew when he was, it was land use planning, and that's when he did this and this and this. She knew all steps in his career. Well, I thought I'd hit all the institutions with her. I thought I'd gotten them all. Till about 5 minutes before I left, I remembered the Chi Omegas. I remembered that Louie's story about meeting her because she was a Chi Omega.
Mm-hmm.
Well, she mentioned.
No, I never heard that.
Oh, yes, Louis. The reason that Louis married her was because somebody at the University of Florida, some Chi Omega that he knew at the University of Florida, said to him, oh, I have three friends that you must meet, Chi Omegas in New York. And that's how he met Mrs. Neeland, and that's how he married her. I mean, made contact there.
When he was in the Army.
Mm-hmm, when he was in the Army.
Yeah, on leave, shore leave.
Yeah.
Well, so she was talking about, I believe she was talking about some of the planting being done around Gainesville. Oh, the city beautification, putting up red buds and dogwoods and things like that. And she mentioned the Chi Omega house, and it clicked. I thought, aha, she's a Chi, I remembered she was a Chi Omega. And I said, did you ever have anything to do with those sororities, Mrs. Neeland? Oh, she said, I am a Chi Omega. Well, turns out that when they made this co-educational. They bought all that land for Sorority Row, and they parceled it out and sold it to all the sororities, and then they had to draw lots to see where they could build their house. Well, the Chi Omegas drew third, and they got to the third best lot, and then there was the problem of building a house. Well, all the alumni got together, Mrs. Neeland among them, and apparently there was a very nice Chi Omega house in South Florida, and Mrs. Neeland had seen it. And she said to them, if they have one down there's no reason that we can't have one up here. She said, well, they elected me president. So she was president of the building, the building board or the building commission to get this house built. And work out all the mortgages and loans and all that.
In the 30s?
No, this was in the 50s. What, in the 30s? No, it was in the early 50s.
Oh.
Wasn't
she did all this. It wasn't co-ed until 47, and the house was built, I think, in 51 or something like that. So she was terribly involved with the Chi Omegas for about 20 years. She said lately she hasn't had too much to do with them. Said they don't want us around now. But for 20 years, she was alumni advisor and looking out for the building and everything.
And now they don't want them around. Don't you know?
But as I was getting ready to leave, Mrs. Neeland said, you know, I have something that maybe you could use. I have upstairs Mr. Neeland's scrapbook when he retired. I say this to you that we must guard that with our life, souls, bodies, everything else. She gave it to me in a plastic sack so that we wouldn't get it dirty. And I'm to take it back to her next week. Friday of next week.
His scrapbook.
Yes. All the letters that were written to him. It's filled with letters that were written to him by all the county agents in Florida.
Oh, my.
When he retired. There are all kinds of articles that were written about him when he retired. Magazine articles, all kinds of things.
Well, Lord help us.
And she's got it.
It's upstairs.
Lord help us.
So,
well, what do you know?
Told her we'd like to read it.
Yes.
And
when he retired in
57.
The year I came. Well, what do you know?
And she just went and got it freely.
She just went running back and got it.
Well, what do you know? Isn't that something? Isn't that something?
Sure.
Debbie feels very responsible for it. She said it can't be thrown around.
Certainly can't. It has to be handled with very carefully.
You can Xerox it.
Can Xerox it, yes. But it doesn't open very well. You know, it's one of those bound scrapbooks. So
yeah,
it doesn't open all the way.
Pull everything out of it.
Oh. Look, I want to maintain lines of communication there. We have to take that scrapbook back in good condition.
Just bust the binding.
That's what you were all the way out of here. Xerox of this thing. I've got to hold it, she said. She had it on the front seat all wrapped up.
What do you know? What do you know? Well, now that ought to tell us a great deal.
I think so. There are a couple of articles that he wrote, Mr. Neeland wrote himself. And then one of them, she said, is very funny because it has a lot of anecdotes about when he was extension forester. And then there are all the newspaper articles that were written when he retired, and all the letters. And there must be 100 letters that are all signed, la 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 la, county agent, la 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 la, county agent.
Well, what do you know? What do you know?
Well, this is something to let out of your hands.
And he was an extension forester when he retired at the university.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And this was from the county agents that he worked with. Well, what do you know? Well, isn't that something?
She told you she had a present. That's all she told me was. I said, what in the world is this thing? And she had to tell me. Oh, Lord. daughter has a standing invitation to go back weekly.
Oh, my.
Well, you know, I'd go just to talk with her. Now you've got this much, you see, that's what happened when we started making the tapes. Thought, well, two or three tapes, that's enough on them. And then we found out, you see, that their world constantly expanded as we talked to them. We see more of them, yes, but also of Gainesville, or the Carmakers, or whoever it is.
Yeah, it keeps going, because I certainly saw more of the garden club. Now, we haven't gotten to the women's club or the other women's club.
Mainly, you can see her strength.
Yes, that's, I mean, I'm not particularly interested in the garden club, but I'm interested in the way she works in the garden club, the way she worked when the garden club was active, that she, seeing her working in that short course and standing up to those people but sticking by the rules, it was a time when people could be in an institution and still be an individualist in that institution.
Yeah, yeah.
They didn't have to get out of the institution.
That's right.
And then you see that very clearly in something as simple as a diddly little garden club and Mrs. Neeland.
Yeah.
And also, and that, I think, carries on the public spirit nature of everything that she does, because she had something that she could be public spirited in.
Yes.
The institutions. She could do it in the institutions.
Yes.
She didn't have
to. The institutions worked for her.
Yes, they did. And
yes. And now they're Scotia.
And if you get outside and you try to do something all by yourself in a public spirited nature, you can't do it. One person can't do it. Whereas the institution can go out and plant azaleas up and down old whatever it was street. One person couldn't do it.
Yeah.
So.
That's right.
And now she sees the change, but she doesn't dwell on it. She can go back to when it wasn't like that. And she still is interested. I think she's an individual spirit, because she's still interested in the things that are progressive in the garden club, like this medical therapy and flowers. I mean, that's maybe a little not a good example, but she's interested in the things that are progressive, not flower arranging.
Uh-huh. That's right.
Yeah.
She's interested in planting the gardens.
Yeah.
And she's really doesn't like people who flower arrange and do bonsai plants. She said something about the bonsai plants where you cut the roots and make them little.
Mm-hmm.
She said, well, we've got three circles all tied up in bonsai plants. She said, or how you pronounce it, bozo or whatever it is, dwarf trees. And she has no patience with people who won't take up the welfare projects or who are in circles because they like bridge and are well-to-do. She just has no patience with people like that. She's never been anywhere where she didn't have something to do.
Well, she didn't have to play bridge.
Mm-hmm.
When I called her, it was 2:00, and I apologized. I said, this is the time, I hope I haven't interfered with your nap. But she said, well, no, you haven't, because I never take a nap. And I said, well, Ms. Neeland, I just collapse every once in a while. Well, she said, quite often I feel like it, but so far I have never in my life taken a nap.
My faith.
What she said.
Well, isn't that remarkable? You see, you know what makes people have to take naps is a sort of sweating and sweating I do, you see, on these fool things. It's just, that's what makes people take naps. A healthy human being don't have to take a nap. I've never been that healthy.
She must be high.
Yes, sir. Now you see, Faith, Debbie got 17 times more than I'd have got if I'd have been there.
Yes, you would have. You or I would have had to figure it up 2 or 3 months how in the world we could get one letter out of her. And then she just gives
That's
Debbie
right.
the whole scrapbook.
She gives her the whole scrapbook. That's right.
She better get it all back, too.
Yeah, you see, Miss Mary's got letters over there. She promised to let me see, but she won't even let me see them.
Uh-oh.
She don't even show me her old photograph. Well, I was fighting, I guess.
Well, I can see some Xeroxing going on.
Yeah. Ooh. Well, we ought to pick out the best ones. Don't need to Xerox the whole scrapbook.
Mm-hmm. So. What do you know?
There are all kinds of dried flowers in it, too. All Mr. Nealon's flowers.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
See, she's holding out. She didn't bring it down and put it on the table.
I'll go get it if you want it. You want to see it?
No.
I'll go get it.
You better
know. I just didn't bring it down for dinner. That's all. I'm scared somebody spill something on it.
Debbie won't breathe until that thing's back.
It's a weight over my head.
That's
I feel like
if you go to sleep with it, if the house caught on fire, you want to be sure and take that scrapbook out.
I was really touched that she'd lend it to us, and I just think we ought to take good care of it. That's all.
It's really not good judgment, is it?
To take it?
To lend it.
No.
Hot dogs,
that's right. Perfect stranger.
Now, those three brothers, one of them, you don't know anything about him, the one that died.
All I know is that he worked for the post office and in California. He went back to California, too, and he died of TB. So.
But you don't know anything about him.
But the other two, one got kicked out of the university.
That's the oldest one.
The oldest one, Fred, got kicked out of the university for being outspoken. And the youngest one...
Oh, that must have taken a right smart to...
I wonder what I wanted to know. I mean, there's a lot more to know about those brothers. And then I think she liked the youngest one, who wanted to be an actor, who she thought should have been an actor. And I said, oh, did he act here at the university? She said, oh, he should have been an actor or a politician. He had a words. Words. She said no. She didn't think he acted here, but she thought he did out in California.
Yeah.
So, but they all split from the farm. Only Louis stayed and took care of the farm in Flagler County.
Yeah.
The rest of them took off. That was the arrangement.
Well, and then you don't know what happened to his stepfather.
Stepfather, no. I know. I think it's on. Mr. Nealon has told us, I think, on
back.
Some of the tapes. He went back to California,
mm-hmm.
I think.
Yeah. Where he could breathe.
But right from the beginning, they knew he couldn't breathe. First day they landed in Jacksonville, got off the train and went to the docks to get the boat, and they lost him because he couldn't breathe. He was down on the docks trying to breathe in the fresh air.
Oh, the whole thing.
They knew from the first day.
Hmm. It was so low.
And still they stuck it out.
Mm-hmm.
Gee whiz, he was here several years.
The father, yes. The stepfather was here all through the war. He kept the farm while all the boys went to war.
And while Louis went to school.
Mm-hmm.
And the other boy, too, must have gone to school then. Fred.
Well, in California, you know, where they lived, evidently it was high, too.
Mm-hmm.
And far from the
Sierras. Oh, it was in the hills.
Oh, it was
in the Sierras.
The Sierras, that's right.
So suddenly, you know, then he's way down low. Pretty bad.
Now, what do you know? What do you know? What do you know? But now, you see, I've had no association with... these people with a flair of that sort. I don't know anybody like that. Like Louis and his older brother in that Edwardian era before. before the war. I don't know anybody like that. But now, are they all the brothers went to the war?
All of them.
Four of them.
Mm-hmm. They all came back, except the one brother got TB in the war.
Gee whiz.
And there's no secret. She just told you that he got kicked out of the university.
She didn't go into it. Uh-huh. Now, that'll have to wait for next week.
Outspoken.
She just said he was outspoken.
Yeah, uh-huh, because of that.
Because he was outspoken, he got kicked out.
Yeah. Well, she wasn't here. But she...
No, she's telling what Louis told her.
But she knows him.
Yes. She would know him well. One of them, she was telling me, one of them she only saw once. I think that was the one that died.
Yeah.
Just came to visit once. And then the one that's living in Mexico now, I suppose they've seen more often. And then the oldest brother, Fred, lived in New Smyrna Beach.
Uh-huh.
He stayed in Florida, so they must have seen him a lot.
Yes.
He's right here in the state.
Yes. Yes, and you know how the relatives, at one time, you see, they did a whole lot of mixing. Brothers, anyhow, wouldn't they?
Mm-hmm.
Well, what do you know? So all the time, Louis was county agent in this public office. His brother was down there, too.
Working on the railways.
Yeah, you don't know what doing.
Started out as a... I have it written down. I don't remember what... He started out as brakeman?
Brakeman.
And then eventually did something else with him.
What do you know? Well, that was the end of the railroad era when he got into it, wasn't it?
That was a big time in Florida too, with railroads.
Mm-hmm.
Flagler and the other big, all the booms, Florida. Flagler and somebody.
Kellogg, Tuttle.
Who's the man who's got the beautiful mansion in Palm Beach with the railroad car in his yard that built railroads into Florida right after the turn of...
Flagler's the one that built the railroads.
Well, maybe it's Flagler's house then. They have his private railroad car with plush walls and it's a museum now,
mm-hmm,
in Palm Beach.
Mm-hmm.
I guess it's Flagler. Talk about Edwardian. Red velvet walls.
Mm-hmm.
That's a world.
Now, you haven't looked at those letters.
Other than I just glanced through and saw the county agent signed them.
Yeah.
We can read some. Why don't I go get them?
It's too long.
I can read a couple. It's only 10 after 8.
You look through them and pick them up. I've had enough for one day. I'm celebrating.
We got to celebrate. Debbie's been working right hard, too.
She's just been on a picnic, if you call that working hard. She didn't even go out and garden.
Mr. Nealon did.
What'd you leave her early for?
I had to go by campus. That's why I left early. The little Girl Scouts came by, too. We discussed the price of Girl Scout cookies, and she said, "See, in everything, all they want you to do is just dip deeper in your pocket."
Yeah.
Tell me about the electrician coming.
Yeah.
She said that socket went bad in the bedroom, and I called the electrician, and he came that day. She said it cost $1.25 for the socket and $15 for the labor.
Right.
I said, "Mrs. Neal, that's not true." She said, "It is." She tells the figures.
Looks like Neelan could fix the socket.
Well, I guess not.
He'll have to reach down his pocket.
what happened to me.
Let me see if I've got speaking.
That's what happened to me. A light in my bedroom wouldn't turn. The bedroom they had in town wouldn't turn on. And I thought, my goodness. So I called an electrician. He came out, put a bulb in, and charged me $15.
I cannot believe that for 10 minutes work,
it wasn't
10
minutes. All he did was just put a bulb in. But I should have had sense enough to try the bulb. I thought I did. Well, my student said, "Miss Mom, are you sure that was right?" It's true. I get the service call.
Well, how many people get their cars towed if they run out of gas?
But I thought I had screwed it in. I thought it was just going just that simple. But he made no apologies. He didn't do anything. He didn't.
I would tell you, my electrical supply. Is over there, upstairs over you on the right. And I've got one of those little things that, like this, that you push on
a switch.
Yeah. I think it is. I don't know where. I thought I had it in here. But
oh.
It'll be over there. I'm going to put it right there on that jigger there.
Let me go see if I can get that.
Oh, don't make a strip. You'll be just taking your pocket.
Well,
didn't that nice?
That was a rich haul.
That was a haul. That was indeed. Well, now let's see.
While you
got the floor, Devin, tell us a little. Oh, she's sitting over there chewing.
Well, she's just almost through. She's through.
I thought we were through. I'm through.
Going on chewing.
Gets it stained.
Tell us a little about Martha.
That's not fair.
Got this new one in the mind.
Now, you've got some of her little reviews?
I have one upstairs, huh?
Any good?
Well, I looked at it to see if she made a statement. I just looked at it for 5 minutes and read the first little bit to see whether she made a statement and whether she had any theatrical criticism in it.
Yeah.
And she
You don't keep sweets around, do you?
No, she doesn't even eat them.
Those are Girl Scout cookies. They're not sweets. That's a different category. Anything that only comes once a year. It's like plum pudding at Christmas.
Does she nibble?
That's one of the things Debbie doesn't do. I nibble, but Debbie doesn't.
Marcia said in the first paragraph of her review, she said that the movie was about the contrast between the good guys and the bad. The good bad guys and the bad guys. Now, that's a stronger statement than I made about Cole Porter. And that's what the movie's about. They're two bank robbers, but one of them's a good bad guy and the other one's a bad guy. And that's what she talks about. One of them's a good bad guy because he doesn't shoot innocent bystanders. He is reasonably nice to his wife. And he gets the bad guy in the end. The other one is a bad guy because he beats up his girlfriend, he shoots innocent bystanders, and he gets killed in the end. And that's how you tell the difference. Now it's like the John Wayne movie. It wasn't much of a movie, but she made something of it. And she made a statement that was simple enough. It's not terribly abstract to say, I mean, it's maybe a little bit confusing to say a good bad guy and a bad bad guy. But you get the point.
I think that'd be pretty close to the common thought.
That's how people would look at it. And that's what happens in movies all the time now with gangsters. And it happens in John Wayne, too. John Wayne can be a a good bad guy, not shoot innocent bystanders and not beat up his wife. But he's generally a good guy. He generally is on the side of the law and has all the good qualities, like not shooting innocent bystanders. And then he's opposed to the bad guy. So that in John Wayne, you get a little more of the extremes. You don't have two bad guys that you're looking at. You have a good guy and a bad guy that you're looking at.
Yeah. Is John Wayne right? Is he a pleasant sort of fellow? Is he likable?
He's big. Great, big, enormous man.
Yeah.
And so when he hits somebody in the movie, he knocks them down flat. Yeah. And he's always doing that. He's always knocking somebody down. You see, when John Wayne wants to solve a problem, he does it with his fists.
Yeah.
One scene in the movie, right at the beginning, he tells one of his sidekicks to bring him two good guns, two men who are good guns. So the sidekick comes with these two boys on horseback, and gallop up and stop, and John Wayne looks at him and says, "Well, you guys ready?" And one of the boys says, "Well, what are we doing?" And John Wayne says, we're going with this lady. Out with her. She's it." And the boy says, "Well, what are we doing?" John Wayne looks at him. Then he turns around and he looks at his sidekick and he knocks his sidekick out cold. Just wham, knocks him out, and the two boys with their eyes like this, and the sidekick is down in the dust shaking his head. "What'd you do that for?" he says. And John Wayne says, "I told you to get me two good guns." The whole movie was like that. The best. And John Wayne never shoots innocent bystanders or anything like that. The baby crying is the prime example when they ride into town and hear the baby crying. Also, there are occasionally a few romantic interludes in John Wayne. In this one, Anne Margaret is prancing around as the romantic interest. She is the woman who is taking them out to find the gold. She's the only one that knows what gold is. So there are about two scenes around the campfire where she's making a play for John Wayne. Well, John Wayne comes back with some of the best lines in the movie. John Wayne is a big, stalwart man. He never shoots innocent bystanders, and he never lets a woman turn his head. This woman says, "Well, you know, if you wanted to come back with me on the train," he says, "I won't." She said, "But if you did," and he says, "Lady, I got a saddle that's older than you."
I think I'm going to see that movie.
It's really funny. And John Wayne always takes care of those innocent bystanders. End of the movie. They've gone through absolute hell to get out, find the gold, and get back, and get the woman and the gold back on the train back to civilization, because she's going to take the money to the Wells Fargo people and turn it in and get the reward, which is $50,000. The $50,000 is why John Wayne and his sidekicks have gone along with her. They want their share of the $50,000, see. They're not going to keep all the gold. John Wayne is honest, but he wants his $50,000, and he keeps this hanging over his gang's head the whole time. Well, the last 5 minutes of the movie, dust blowing up around the train. Anne Margaret is standing on the train holding her hands like this because John Wayne is not going with her. He's staying with his old saddle. And John Wayne comes up and all the gang comes behind him, and he pushes forward one of his sidekicks and says, "Go on, tell her." And he looks down and shuffles his feet, and the guy in front shuffles his feet, and John Wayne says, "Go on, tell her." So the guy in front shuffles his feet, and he says, "Well, ma'am, what we wanted to tell you was, well, we decided that you just keep that reward money for you and the boy." She has a 9-year-old son, you see. "You just keep that reward money for you and the boy." And so Ann Margaret's eyes fill up with tears, and John Wayne shuffles his feet and looks at his saddle, and everybody else shuffles their feet, and they all sort of shake their shoulders, and the train starts and goes off, you know, and Ann Margaret is weeping on the steps, and the gang is walking along beside the train. Well, on the back of the train, the man standing on the back and smoking a cigar and says, "Very touching, boys, very touching." And they look up and say, "Who are you?" He says, "I'm with Wells Fargo. I've been chasing that woman for the last 3 years." He says, "You just think Wild Bill was married, don't you? Well, Wild Bill was never married. Her name is Lily, and she comes from Madam So-and-so's house in Las Vegas." So John Wayne is just stricken, you know. He doesn't know what to do. There are only 2 minutes left in the movie, so he jumps on his horse and takes out after the train, and one of his sidekicks says, "Where the hell are you going?" And he says, "To rob a train! What do you think?" They all take out after the train.
Which sounds like a great movie.
Now, what was that theatrical criticism you put in there?
I've forgotten.
This part was well done.
I never said that about John Wayne. I said that about the Cole Porter.
Yeah. Well, you reviewed that too.
Cole Porter?
Uh-huh. Or did you just say that?
Well, I wrote a little bit about Cole Porter.
Oh, I see.
I said that one of the characters was my favorite. That was my topic sentence. It was very bad.
I tell you, Freddie, you just have to get her sort of stirred up a little bit.
She does all right when
she does all right, yeah. What does she do? Just, she must have a bunch of Girl Scout cookies or something. She just says, let's go to bed.
Oh, shoot. Well, this is better than any show.
Oh, yes. Much better. Much better.
Well, you may not like the weekend, but I'm content that it'll be Saturday tomorrow.
You know, the first class I ever really enjoyed in my life was this little old nondescript 300 course they call Advanced Composition. Nobody wanted it. So ever you they just take turn about. And I had it one time and I liked it. After I got rid of that Brooks and Warren text. Oh, they had a dilly of a text and I tried to use it and it just about killed me. And you didn't need any text in it. All you had to do was they wrote papers. And they wrote about things they knew about. And you didn't have Yeats and James and all those people who were standing in between you all the time. And I remember all those people. Just one after another. And I even remember what they wrote about. And one boy wrote on, he was a mail carrier, and his daddy was, or he was, and he wore out tires. And he had a whole paper on what he did about it. And I lost the paper, and I've looked for that again and again. You see, he'd drive 100 or 200 miles a day, and those tires, you see, they just won't hold up forever. And I could, you see, the thing, that is the time I think I first said I could teach them how to make a report and tell about their experiences. And, but I'd never see them again, so I get no benefit from it, you see. If I could just teach some of my neighbors, where I could listen to the reporting every now and then. That's way back then, you see. It was nice. It was indeed.
Well, Debbie's earned her grits tonight. Rick, I guess you have too.
Nice your Girl Scout cookie.
Boy, Girl Scouts are vandals these days. These kids are coming around selling them with a shopping cart from a supermarket. I wanted to ask them where they got it, but I thought better of it.
With a what?
You know, one of those shopping carts that you go to a supermarket and you have wire shopping carts.
Oh, yes.
The only place you can get one is in a supermarket or a big discount department store like Zayers or something.
Yeah.
They were selling Girl Scout cookies out of it.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. Three innocent little brownies. They were really innocent. They're big-time operators. Boy, they've got their lists of who's bought what kind of cookie.
Well, you know, they take those carts out from, I know now Publix has put some posts up around where you can't get them out. Maybe Wendy's they have too. But I see those carts out all over the parking lot. Mm-hmm. Anybody can
take
one or two, take them off.
What was the third Girl Scout motto?
Yeah.
Thou shalt be honest. Oh, Mrs. Neeland is honest. She's just...
Yeah, it's always good, Bridget.
She said she was in charge of she was corresponding secretary for the garden club one time. She said usually what people did were they bought the rolls of stamps and then you could just use one once in a while, she said, and it would never get on the record. She said, I kept a list of all the correspondence that I sent out and how much it cost.
She did.
No rolls of stamps for her. She said, I just figured it was more honest. See, you worked for the institution then. You didn't... Boy, when I worked for Tufts, we used to write all our letters on Tufts letterhead. We never thought of that as stealing, but of course it was stealing. Taking Tufts paper.
Yeah. Just like taking a call from the hotel, isn't it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Did you run them through the stamp machine, too?
No, we didn't have a stamp machine. We didn't do that. But we wrote personal letters on letterhead stationery and letterhead envelopes.
I used to have a hotel stationery around.
Well, that you're supposed to take.
yeah, that's not necessarily...
That's advertising.
Too hard on me.
Well, that's being used.
Well... The only thing that bothers me tonight is the weekend is coming up. I just despise weekends. Just give me the days of the week, regular weekdays.
Well, all I'm going to do tomorrow is try to find out where those cabbages come from. Where they got those cabbages?
Go back there.
Somebody grows them right there close.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you do that, Faye.
It's too bad you can't rob a bunch and freeze them.
Yes.
I bet they'd keep a while.
Deb and I pick up something in the store and put it back down. Deb said, you can't buy that. It's just... It's so high.
Puny little vegetable.
Yeah. Little piece of bib lettuce about that big was 50 cents.
Yeah.
It's since last week. And usually I don't pay any attention. Thank you, Miss Debbie.
You got fired for being outspoken.
Fred and Edwin and Lewis and
Clarence,
I think, or Chauncey or something like that. Again, see, I haven't.
Keep your scrapbook close to you.
Keep it close to me. I just don't want any big stories next week about, well, we have to Xerox two more pages when I have to take it back. It can't be like Mr. Weaver's picture.
They're getting pretty much like your own children. They'll take care of you.
Rick needs a Alexa. He ought to be able to jump up and down. He can go jump up and down all he wants to. See, I listen better than they do, you see. I like it better than they do. I just like it. See, that just suits me. Nothing pleases me so much as this sort of talk. But that old quippy talk, I don't want it. When they can do things like this.